potentially come together in a way that, where some group value can be created as opposed to just identifying some kind of external characteristics. So that was quite interesting. And obviously, I tried to put both comments in line, but also comments at the end, as you have questions or reactions to that, please send me a mail. Everybody did great. I have to say, I really enjoyed this pile of papers. However, I will also say pro forma that I have my rewrite policy is unlimited rewrites. So if you want to take another stab at this, if there's something you want to add, even a minor edit, I would be happy to read it again. So, because obviously, most writing is actually rewriting. So, just that's a good way to get some of the issues. So, what I want to do today we are finishing up, and you may have seen from the readings for next week, we're turning our attention to much more. Technology-oriented analysis. We're not really technology-oriented, but analysis of the dilemmas of mediated groups. Not just groups, the kind of group dilemmas we've been talking about all semester up until now, but specifically the dilemmas and issues of groups that spend some or all, that have some or all of their group activity played out in media, and will be especially interested in electronic media. Obviously, almost all groups have something or other to do with media, whether there's a newsletter or some kind of broadcast. But we're in, as I think we said in the thesis in the first week in class, we haven't talked that much since, we are in a kind of golden age of experimentation with groups because the internet is has provided a model, and now the phone network is also catching up with it with SMS and WAP and so forth, of a medium that's natively good at supporting groups. It was interesting to me the number of people in the papers who said, we could bring up a listserv, right? I mean, that's something that within the fabric of this community, first of all, there's a precedent for it, but second of all, it's obviously a relatively lightweight way of forming groups, and we'll turn our attention to that today. What I want to do first is I want to talk about the readings, and then I want to essentially stop and tell the story so far. Right? What do we start with? What have we got to? Because today is the last of the days of purely sociological readings, not concerned with media groups. After this, our focus will narrow from the platform we've built. So I want to turn attention first to the social capital, and then to the essentially want to retell the story of the class as a kind of coherent narrative. Of course, the readings are different facets, but there is obviously a kind of underlying thread of interest. So, what is social capital? Do you feel more sure or less sure after these two readings?
Less sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously I picked two people who are expressing dissenting points of view with one another. But if you had to pick something, I don't know, generic enough that it would blanket the two readings, what would it be?
I was thinking about it like social capital being. That's something that promotes the well-being of that specific group. But then there could be such a capital among the people, and we said before that not necessarily to be part of a group.
Now there is a big debate. I should say that is a personal preference of mine. There's a big debate in the sociological literature about whether or not two people are in a group. And the Kant says yes, and Ms. Kant says no. I think the important thing to recognize is less the litmus test than that there's a set of effects that kick in at three that don't exist with two. But right, so the question is, can social capital exist between two people?
Yeah. Not very much in the way that they're describing it.
Right. So what's the
I don't know if that's true. Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of partnership or something that's creating an incredible amount of of value in those ties.
I'm thinking even the opposite of where you might have like a KKK member and a black man, or you know, or some minority. You know, I guess it's the antithesis of social capital, but I mean the relationship that they have with their own groups, you know, kind of gives off the opposite, I guess.
We push them to have be more confrontational with one another, you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not necessarily social capital according to their definitions, but
I'm less worried. I mean, first of all, as I think you can see from the argument, there's a general sense that something called social capital exists, and there's an attempt to define it in ways that heighten particular ideological stances. Francis Fukuyama is a neoconservative and relatively libertarian, and so he's committed to the idea that there's not a market failure around social capital, but that individuals will provision all the social capital they need without it being a group effect. And the InFed encyclopedia definition, the article from InFed, is much more oriented around group provision. So I don't want you to, you know, I don't want you to think that there's, you know, one of these two is right and the other's wrong, we're going to reveal it at the end of the discussion. But there's obviously something here. And a lot of it comes out in these questions. Can you have social capital between two people? Let me put it a different way. The kinds of effects that social capital produces, is there a better explanation for what happens between two people? Or is there a difference between what happens between two people and what happens with the group?
In terms of social capital?
In terms of social capital, yes.
I think that to a large degree what they were saying are some of the points that they were bringing out about what social capital does for a society can apply only to a society of a greater number of people than two. Mm-hmm. Because what they're talking about is the collective betterment in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. So the fabric that this social capital kind of, you know, the fabric that it's kind of stitched together when all these people come together and either share a common cause or have a viewpoint or do, you know, something in a,
I mean, is there social,
as a collective.
Is there social capital in a marriage, though?
Right. Well, there is, but not in the way, I get the feeling from, and I can't remember which reading was which, but in one of them in particular, they're talking about the betterment of society and how, you know, everybody's lives are improved in general when we have, you know, a network of people that all have a common cause. But and if that's only between two, then it only influences those two people, although you can say a married couple and other married couples can get together and do the same thing.
What's the relation? You know, if you add three, is it just like plus one? Like that's the, how much extra well, value you know, have, or does it multiply?
Mom and daddy and baby, I think it's the whole family unit. I think what they're talking about is more society.
I think well, that part falls under the family aspect, I think. And in the reading, Jack, he's talking about not just, you know.
Since nobody's seeing you want to jump in, you cut out, you know. Your social capital is low in that part.
Social capital in the case of family is not always viewed as like as an advantage for gain, but also as an obligation. More like an obligation. It's like, oh, you know, my brother got in trouble again, but it's my brother, so I have to go, you know, bail him out or something, you know, that sort of thing. And that can always multiply.
Okay, so what's going on with your brother? I mean, I know your brother's in and out of jail all the time, but what's going on with your brother in terms of your relationship with him?
I don't have a brother. But
fine. I would say that too if I had your brother, but really, what you've got a hypothetical brother. You're bailing him out of jail all the time. What's going on in that relationship, and is that best described as social capital?
The ties?
The commonwealth, and that's share, and one is using the resources more than the other one. Like, one is providing resources for the other one.
Well, I've kind of been put into it.
That's right. I mean, certainly, Rich is bearing in the situation we just imagined. So you're right. In fact, because the hypothetical brother didn't project maybe too much onto it. Imagine some, you know, the State Department always says we have a thick relationship with France, right? France says something to make us mad, we do something to make France mad, and then somebody comes out and says, we have a thick relationship with France. It's not going to go away because of a, you know, even a 5-year long disagreement. Imagine someone that you have a thick relationship with, someone that's pissed you off several times and you're still good friends or close associates with them. What's going on in that relationship, and is that best described by social credit?
It's like a shared history that you do the strong tie.
Right, and shared history. What there's and I am there's a particular reading that we did that describes the effect of that shared history on the relationship.
It's mutual destiny in a way, uh-huh. A commitment.
Right.
A commitment that is based on mutual destiny.
I think maybe one of the differences is that with a family, it's not all these other groups that are examples are groups that are usually brought together by an event, or they're brought together. Basically, all the members of the group have agreed to become part of the group. You know, even if it's just the AARP or whatever. With family, though, you're kind of born into it.
Mm-hmm.
You're forced into that group. You know, and it's the norm. Every family kind of takes care of their own, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm No, that's right. I mean, so
maybe you could say the larger group of society is deemed it, like the smaller groups, the families, you know, there's certain responsibilities that they take within the...
So here's, Fouquet on the particular mentions a pathological case of society around exactly this thing that Rich is talking about with family. What is it?
The mafia?
Yeah. And what's that social dynamic?
Well, I mean, I don't know if this is exactly what you're reading up to, but I remember somewhere that, you know, because it's such a tightly knit society that they have a lot of power, but they also have exclusivity.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. But there's a specific example in the Fukuyama where he says, this is the social structure of Southern Italy at a particular point in time. What was that social structure?
What was the set of rules?
Yeah.
It was like a private, there was a lack of safety in public space, or the government wasn't allowing it, so private had to take over that.
And do you remember what the rules were for who you would cooperate with and who you defect against?
Only the family first.
Cooperate with the family, defect against outsiders, and every family had the same set of rules. Social capital, high or low in society?
Because you're only concerned with your immediate family members and thereby not connecting families.
Oh, it's high inside the family and low in between the families.
Right. So social capital has to be seen as, you have to specify the level of the group of what you're talking about before you can talk about whether there's social capital. Within a family, social capital is very high. And Rich raised the idea of the Ku Klux Klan, right? Within the Ku Klux Klan, the social capital is very high. In societies in which the Ku Klux Klan operated, considered as a whole, if you take account of the black population as well as the white population, social capital averaged as a whole goes out. And they talk about this. One of the externalities of social capital is often exclusivity. In fact, I think you triggered that when you tried to start TNOOT and triggered the threat of, is this a diss on TNO? Right? So right away, starting anything that has an in-group, you generate an out-group.
And that's pretty core to the human experience. Like anthropologically, most societies have like one name. Humans is like our tribe, and you know, barbarians are outsiders. Is everyone else? Right?
Yes, the Goyim. What does that word actually mean? Is it outsiders?
Well, barbarian.
No.
Goyim.
It's people. Like, I mean. Nations.
Outside. And then there's Guaylo. Like every culture has at least one. English, sadly, has a rich vocabulary of words that mean outsider. And there's a passage in the Bayan, I don't think it was the reading I assigned, but Bayan said, you know, nothing solidifies a group like an external enemy. And groups often, if they don't actually have an external enemy, they often gravitate towards paranoid leaders. Because those are people who are very good at identifying external enemies. Those people tend to be able to trigger that kind of reaction in the group. What's the difference then between generating social capital between two people? Let's say for the moment that can happen. generating social capital between two people, generating social capital in family, and generating social capital in society as a whole.
I think it has a lot to do with what I would call momentum.
Uh-huh.
Or, I don't know, kind of proliferation of this thing called social capital.
But what's harder about doing it? Harder about doing it at large scale.
You have to find common ground with people so they identify with each other and it's easier to pull them together.
Well, I think there's actually two different effects, and I wouldn't say it's necessarily a numerical thing, but it's related, in which is there's like something that emerges from a personal interaction, and something that just sort of has more of like just sort of floats around as part of the culture. And it's not a one-to-one exchange, but...
So where does the culture live if it doesn't live in either people or interactions?
It lives in tradition.
No, I mean, it lives in part in all of them, but it's also an emerging property that comes from...
The culture is a social capital, huh?
Well, a culture can have varying degrees of social capital, as with the Southern Italy example. Fukuyama calls the effect he's looking at spontaneous sociability. So spontaneous sociability is, as he also puts it, it's that set of, and Fukuyama specifically says, it's that set of informal norms, right? It can't be law, or it's not social capital, it's the law, it's a different thing. It's a set of informal norms that encourages or allows for cooperation between two people in the group you're studying. So what's hard about making cooperation happen? What's the risk of cooperating with someone?
Compromising.
Compromising is a risk.
The effects.
You come to me and you say, hey, can you lend me $20 till Thursday? What have I got at stake in that transaction? $20. Right? Or I get $20, but I get it back a year later. So the time costs the money. I don't have to be out the whole $20, but I can enormously inconvenience myself. In fact, why would I ever lend anyone $20? Come to think of it.
Because maybe sometimes when you
you'll need $40.
Maybe I'll need $40. Right? Exactly. First of all, not the $20, and then. Right. So if I do this, right?
This seems to me like part of the reading where these are all starting to kind of mix together. But there's something in there that says you invite somebody into your home under the assumption that they're not going to steal your wallet and steal your spoons, and not that you've made a formalized agreement that okay, I'm going to let you in with the understanding that you're not going to steal from me.
Here's the form.
Right. Exactly. But it's just understood and. You know, maybe that goes back to what we were just talking about a second ago, where these things are just, where is the social capital? It's just an understanding. You know, it doesn't have to be formally stated. It's something that I guess is learned over the course of time, through interactions. And
this is something I feel like very strange about something we don't have in Israel. And it's when you that you're supposed to sign somebody on a contract if you want to take a picture of him?
If you plan. Commercial form if you're going to get paid for it.
If it has commercial ends.
Commercial interests. Then rightfully you have.
Only in cases of commercial interests?
Normally.
I don't know exactly.
The law is very, very unclear. Because you can take snapshots. You can take vacation snapshots, and other people happen to be on the same beach as you. You don't need to get model release.
But if I'm doing a project for school,
I don't know. But yeah, it is. America is an unusually litigious environment right now.
And the problem with that is, like, if you broadcast that image and then that person sees that you broadcasted the image without their consent,
and now
then you can get in trouble.
All images are really very mediated now. And if I put the image on in Flickr,
you'll publish that it.
That's publishing. Sure is.
But so let's go back to cooperation and defection, which came up a minute we glossed over it. Who am I going to lend $20 to, and who am I not going to lend?
You being Clay Shirky.
Me being Clay Shirky, yeah. No, the real one. $20 for Red. If Red's out $20, am I going to spot his money? You bet. You bet. I'd go to the ATM and come back. Am I going to lend a student $20? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Why?
There's a way to get it back somehow.
And what is that way?
Well, you trust the person first of all.
Right.
That's the social capital.
And there's
let's say it's the first year I've never met.
There's a belonging.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a community.
Group, and you are connected to rent or finance.
Yeah, that group is giving you a guarantee of the integrity of that person's paying back.
It's like that eBay escrow thing where you might not get the $20 back, but it does affect the community. It gets into the community. So
right. It doesn't always have
effects that person
coming back on the time.
Like the community service is the guarantor.
Right. It's not actually the guarantor. Interesting. And this is, I think, Yellen's point, is that I may, in fact, well be asked for bucks.
Right.
It's the enforcer. Right, it's the producer of social capital has this downside of in non-iterated games of Prisoner's Dilemma, I need some way to get out of the likelihood that someone else is going to defect on me. Because in fact, that if they see me cooperating in a non-iterated game of Prisoner's Dilemma, like Prisoner's Dilemma is imagined as synchronous and non-communicative. But in fact, if I'm handing a 20 across the table,
right,
it's not only non-iterated, it's asynchronous and I go first.
Right.
Right. So I'm putting myself in the position of, here, this is $20, absolutely at risk. And I don't in fact have a guarantee of getting it back.
Right.
What do I have?
You have the guarantee of like the social authorization or whatever if they don't.
Right.
Right.
And that social capital is our way of enforcing something like iteration on non-iterated transactions. It's deeper than that, obviously. It's not, I mean, there really are altruistic acts. And when you help a blind person across the street, okay, there's almost no chain by which that person comes back to benefit you equally, right? The asymmetry of their need and the hassle to you makes it easy to engage in. But that is a costly transaction, right? So I don't mean to suggest that all altruism is secretly risk mitigation. There are genuinely altruistic acts as well. But a lot of what we call social capital allows people to trust each other without needing either iteration or what Axelrod called the shadow of the future. And Mona, this is what I was trying to get at when you talk about the family and the sort of history. What history gives you is the background of the shadow of the future. Right? I can see having interacted with this person, right? And you can see this among your friends and colleagues. Right? There are people you would lend money to, but you wouldn't go out to dinner with, and vice versa. Right. Or rather, you could imagine those questions. Not everyone may have that person in their lives right now, but you can make those kinds of distinctions. So it's not an absolute, unlike capital, interestingly. Social capital isn't fungible. Right? I can trade you a 10 for 2 5s, but we can forget that transaction happened. It's so meaningless.
Right.
Social capital is like that in that it's not directly convertible from one thing to another. Other thing about social capital that's quite odd, and in fact, in a way, the most objectionable thing about social capital is by calling it capital, it encourages people to use a metaphor of money, which really overstates a lot of, or misstates a lot of what happens in social capital. Yes?
I'm still trying to think how social capital, if it exists between two people, how it's different, or why it doesn't exist. And I don't really see why. There is an exchange, there is a giving up of your individuality, you need to communicate outwards.
I think it's the part that goes beyond the exchange that becomes where, like, in a group, you might, you know, there's certain things that just sort of float around, and they're word of mouth, whisper, and, like, you know, they're transmitted in certain ways, but their effects are not comparable, the fact that somebody just whispered to somebody else that, like, somebody didn't pay back $20, you know.
So I'll give my answer, and again, with the bias that I'm in the three as a group camp, and that is that when you're looking at two people, you have to look at their history and not just the transaction. If it's two people who know each other before, that classic prisoner's dilemma effects are enough to explain their willingness to trust one another, right? If I've done business with you in the past, or I, you know, whatever, we have a history of doing these things, if I lend my friend $20, that doesn't significantly add to the stock of social capital in the culture as a whole, whatever culture we're in. Because in a way, we're a culture of two, right? And it's relatively easy, especially with people you iterate with frequently, to set up norms of high trust, even in environments of low trust. This and moving along that axis, that explains the Southern Italy example that Fukuyama brings up. If it's two people who don't know each other and are unlikely to interact in other ways, right, but are still aiding one another, then yes, it's social capital. If you're walking a blind person across the street, that's social capital. Because you're either trusting that that will be rewarded somehow, or that it at least won't. It won't cost you any more than having to cross the street more slowly or having to cross the street more.
Is that really social capital, or is that just a personal altruistic act, though?
Well, so it's a personal altruistic act if it doesn't ramify through society at large. If it doesn't help set up norms that say people, you help walk blind people across the street.
So the fact that you look at somebody and say, I should walk this blind person across the street, so that's what's expected of me is social capital.
It's culture.
Culture, right. It is a part of the culture, right? You either do it, and it's not necessarily in that case for everyone to do it all the time, right? Or every blind person would be mobbed at every corner. Right? it's got to be enough so that one person is willing to do that frequently enough that it works out. I understand, first of all, from my own wife, but more generally, that the norm of giving your seat up to a pregnant woman in the subway has subsided in this city in the last 10 years.
I'm trying also to ask the same question. It seems like the social capital between people is established on the trust, on the personal trust between the people. And the social capital between a group is not necessarily towards the person, but trust towards an idea.
Towards a culture.
Culture, idea, or something. I don't have to trust or feel that I belong to you, but maybe we share an idea. But I feel that if it's more of a close or small group, I have to trust you or belong or feel. Otherwise, there is no social capital between us. It is either exists or it doesn't exist. It's very...
Well, the
black and white, but rather than with a big group, I probably don't even know all the people, but we might share something, some kind of trust.
It's as if there's a kind of a social fact that we should have an interest in social capital, and in that way we should benefit to the creation of this social capital, but. Like when I'm, because in the example you gave with the blind man, I can become blind sometimes. Mm-hmm. So it's not this person. It's I'm contributing to the idea that
blind people. Norm is blind people take care of.
Isn't there like to me it seems like there's like some kind of quantitative benefit difference. Like why did the mafia, why does that exist? Isn't it better for all of them if there wasn't a mafia instead of goes higher up on the chain, like more social capital distributed more evenly between them? Why does they choose to have a mafia regulate those things and then lower down? It seems like there's some kind of more benefit of some kind to having smaller groups with tighter social.
There's a benefit to a mafia. Like if you ever live in a mafia neighborhood, like there's no one's gonna rob you, you know.
But Right, but I mean,
but, yeah, but I think he means
taxed, right?
There's a trade-off between yeah.
It shaves several points of Europe's GDP. Sicily's GDP has not been of the finest.
And what makes that different? Why like how did that choice happen for?
Well, how in that particular case, how it happened is there aren't very good written records, but once it's in place, so and I think this may get it, the thing that Nurit was talking about as well. What I was saying earlier, social capital is, comparison with money is unfortunate because it's largely inaccurate. Right? We know in money that more open trade systems generates, although it generates unequal outcomes for some of the participants, generates more rapid growth in the system as a whole. That's not true of social capital, which is to say, you're likelier to trust second years. Or let's put it another way. Imagine a request to loan an amount of money. You're likelier to loan a higher amount of money or for a longer period of time to someone you know well than to someone you know less well. So you're a group of friends, people in either the first year or second year class, IPP as a whole. By the time you get to Tisch as a whole, you're already, I mean, effectively, people on the eighth floor are almost as random as people hanging out at Master Place, right? So, since social capital is easier to produce in denser environments, there's a way in which the blood is thicker than water issue. There's a way in which social capital within families is naturally stronger, or rather, has a substrate in which naturally can become. The second thing is, once you develop the norm of, and this is in the Axelrod, once you develop a norm of cooperate with family, defect against outsiders, it's very difficult to break out of that norm because the people with the most incentive to break out of that norm have the least social capital. So it actually takes a pretty significant shock to the system. There's a similar effect right now in China where many business deals are done on the basis of Guangxian, absolutely mutilating that word, I cannot pronounce it, but it means essentially strong connections. And it has to do with family ties plus business ties, and it's something that is said to be vested in an individual. You have good Guangxian, you do not have good Guangxian. And there was an economic study done some years ago, the results were published among other places in The Economist, saying that Guangxi seems to be a replacement for the rule of law, right? That says I can't trust the Chinese government to enforce a contract as being legally binding, especially if the contract seems to be in the government's interests. Then I require some other enforcement mechanism, and social capital becomes that enforcement mechanism. But it is unequally distributed and tends to be more concentrated in smaller groups than in larger groups. So that's actually one of the big asterisks about social capital. Is as attractive as the idea is that societies, when they all agree to cooperate with one another, generate more social capital, it doesn't happen in the same way that they generate more actual capital when they agree to trade with one another. And in fact, the tighter groups solve coordination problems more easily than broader groups. And if you don't have someone in the sort of supra position, a Visa or an eBay, these kinds of places that look across the whole system, the enforcement mechanism, in this example we've been using, the enforcement mechanism for getting your 20 back, at ITP it's quite strong. In Tisch it's already pretty weak, and by the time you cross to Astro Blaze, it is nil. Right? And that's... you could barely notice that somebody drinking a mud truck coffee, right? Mud truck, like, it's the same people every day. I'm trying to imagine whether or not I could go to those people and say, listen, the guy in the furry hat borrowed a 20 from me. I haven't seen him in 2 days. If you see him, tell him I'm looking for him. Like you could maybe just barely imagine kind of hooks you could put some stuff together.
But this example is quite extreme, the money example, because it's not yes or no. I want to lend money to this person, but the question is, do I not have any social capital?
No, that's right. Money is just a particular threshold, right? And so if it's I'm trying to imagine, because then
it's
like lending a hat.
It's interesting that you picked up the money example.
Right. Can I borrow your cell phone? I'm going to make a call.
Yeah.
Someone this payphone is out.
Someone said that to me, literally, I mean, this just happened to me. Standing outside McDonald's waiting across the street, some woman approached me and said, excuse me, can I borrow your cell phone for a minute? And I thought, just a complete and utter stranger asking to borrow my phone.
Mm-hmm. That's personal.
Yeah, of course I said no.
But afterward, it occurred to me, like, why?
I asked.
I asked her to borrow my cell phone, and this girl was like, can I borrow your phone? And I was like, okay. And she's like, my phone died, and I need to find my friend. And she was like,
I don't know if I would.
So did you
blend it, but
I both said yes.
So what's different between these two scenarios? Explain yours again.
Well, I mean, a complete stranger approached me right outside of the balance. A woman, I don't know, Scandinavian, she had an accent. not that it matters, but just to give you the details.
It does matter because you have less social...
In New York City, I mean...
But you did recognize it as being foreign.
Yeah.
If he's a foreigner, you might be more likely to help, because you know that
that
they
makes
you
that.
They need it.
What I'm saying is that, for all I know, this woman could have been my next-door neighbor, and I didn't know her from anybody else. If I did know my next-door neighbor and she happened to be Scandinavian, you see what I mean?
That would be good.
I kind of wonder what that says about social, just social capital between different geographic areas. For instance, I had two friends 2 weeks ago who came up to visit, and they did two things that I would have probably never done, and one of them was exactly that. We were in, Grand Central, and some girl just came up and said, hey, can I borrow your phone? My phone died. And my friend, he's from a more rural area.
Sure.
She used the phone. We're sitting there for about two or three minutes, having this person talk. The other thing she did was, a bum had come up and said, oh, I need, I want money. And I usually just do the New Yorker thing and just walk by. And one of them is like, everybody wants money. This girl starts reaching in her pocket, and I'm like, So I had to give the guy like 50 cents for us to keep moving. So, I think that's kind of interesting. What's that say about social capital whenever you're around so many groups versus whenever it's a lot more, spread out.
Mm-hmm. But the two of you said there was something that I think may be different in these two scenarios that I want to pull out, and it may be true in your... you're in Corolla stores are closer right now than David's store. So keep going with your story. What did she say when she came up?
She didn't specify any particular reason why she had to borrow her phone. She just said, can I borrow your phone? And I looked at it for a second.
The other one has a phone that died, makes it more trustworthy in a sense. Right. And she knows what the ethics of using a phone are, and it's really temporary.
There's another element here, which is that I didn't have the time.
Right,
not that I would have anyway. But I simply didn't have the time, even if I were with.
Right.
Even where your work was a part of, being for that McDonald's as opposed to Soho or Grand Central. Where it's,
another thing is there's payphones everywhere.
Right.
So why do you have to borrow myself?
Get a quarter.
Drop a quarter in there.
Payphones are slowly decaying into disuse because there's zero incentive to fix them because the revenue stream is down.
But they're still around. That would be much more.
The revenue's on the side of the box.
What's that?
The revenue's on the side of the box.
Right, the revenue's right now in the advertising. But right, yeah, that's right. So you don't need.
But there's actually a really interesting example. There's Frank Lance's partner was telling me this. He was involved in it, and early on in the cell phone companies decided that they needed to scare people about payphones, and so they started conducting these surveys where they would call up people and ask them if they were worried about germs from payphones. So it's just introduced this idea into the it was early, I think it was early 90s, he was saying. It was call up and they're like, yeah, do you worry about germs?
But just to add one last comment to that. If her real objective was to make a phone call and she could have easily used a payphone instead of my phone, I would have been much more obligated to just give her a quarter. And someone would mention that. So, a quarter I could part with and I don't care.
I just have one question.
Yeah. Back to a quarter. It's back to a quarter.
Were you talking on your cell phone, or did she just assume that you had
it? This was literally
in your hand or
out of the blue. She, utter stranger, just approached. And I literally had
everybody
had
a cell phone.
But I think these days, people can easily ask people for asking for their cell phones because people know that it's so cheap, and everybody has the free minutes and whatnot. So, And everybody assumed that everybody kind of owns a cell phone. And right. I think it's kind of casual behavior to ask.
So the social norm is changing around people's expectations of what's possible.
A while back, I was in a car accident, and a person got off the road and walked towards me and brought me her cell phone so that I could call.
Brought
me a cell phone.
Somebody hit me
from behind. And then a woman just walked.
Stopped,
and then brought me.
It's like medical attention.
Right, as common as
I think it very much depends on the situation. I mean, how they approach the question or how they say it to you. Like, she didn't give a reason, but the other woman did give a reason. So, I mean, if one reason sounds valid, then you're probably more likely to do it.
I can imagine a society where everybody just asks everybody to use their cell phone. You know, like, that's the norm. And then there wouldn't be, you wouldn't give a second thought. You'd be like, sure, I'll give my cell phone, and then you get it back.
You could set up that norm, yeah.
I was in Cuba about 5 years ago, and people come up to you and they're like, give me your shoes. And I'm like,
no.
But I'm wearing them. Well, let's go to your hotel, and then you do something. You have a lot of pairs, I have no shoes. And I was like, I think they're too small. I think that's it.
Wow.
And then I said, why don't you come next week before I leave and I'll leave you the shoes. And then I had a huge conversation with my friend when I came back. And I was trying to figure out if it was like the culture that was different because people are not apologetic about asking for things. And, or was it the system that people feel like everybody should have the basic necessities? And they've been indoctrinated that they, you know, like, you have too many shoes, I don't have any shoes, so you should be using your shoes. Because they're not really apologetic, they're like,
you're part of the out-group, and you're better off.
So
that's
another thing that always resonates.
Yeah, it gets something. I read a book about Wanshi, and how they would be like two complete strangers, Chinese strangers somewhere in the world, they meet in Germany, and if they realize that they're from the same town, there's going to be a stronger Wanshi there than with any other around them or any other of their friends from that specific town because their ties are so strong to their hometown.
I was just thinking about David's example, and is it so much... is that decision so much based on the fact that that person was out of your group? I mean, what if there was someone dying, bleeding to death somewhere, and I'm just thinking of all the different factors that are they necessarily part of the group? What if this woman was like extremely attractive versus extremely ugly, or what if she gave you a reasoning as in it was a dire emergency versus
this is Noah's point about that, it's so situational.
Yeah.
But you're always weighing those things all the time. But I think that social capital, there's a kind of baseline set of assumptions, and then you can do things to push them up or down. But there's essentially sort of cultural norms. If somebody did it within ITP, he would not have blinked an eye.
Exactly.
And so
but as if he was like a Hutu, and the other person was like a Tutsi. I'm just saying, like, is there a point where you can draw
Hutu
a line?
Hutu and Tutsi.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
No, it's like,
but you're a first year, I'm not going to give you my phone. Yeah, know that. All right, so let me put this in a more projective mode, based on essentially the way you wrote the paper and talking about social capital. One of the things that's come up consistently whenever we have discussions about group dynamics at ITP, really in any of the classes that subject has come up, is critique culture at ITP. And it's come up persistently across a fairly wide range of classes and conversations. Seems to me, and one of the issues that comes up with critique culture is critique, especially from within the art school tradition, can be brutal. And that there seems to me to be a potential social capital issue there, which is I understand from the outset that the essentially the social life at ITP is relatively supportive and relatively boosterish. The people doing work is regarded as good. This is the sort of the Gertrude Stein axiom: artists don't need criticism; they need encouragement. It seems to me that you, without saying whether or not more or sharper critique would be a good idea, because I don't have a official view on that, but if you wanted as a goal to increase the directness of critique at ITP, what would you do?
I think it's not about more critique or less critique, it's just that there's different ways to critique. In architecture school, you critique work in one way, and in fine arts school, you critique work in a different way. Mm-hmm. But
I think that there are things that ITP sees itself as being like the people coming here from different backgrounds, but like there are some ideas that ITP sees as its own, and under that set of ideas, you can develop a critic culture.
So
but
develop a new one, because it feels like everyone is pulling towards whatever they know or they're coming from, instead of creating a new way of critique. Because this department, think about all these art schools are more than, I don't know, 100 years old. This is a new program. We didn't develop yet, I feel, that we didn't develop yet a way to critique our work, the way we work. There's a very famous article in the government, it's an art critic, and he was talking about in the 70s, how do you critique a work of art? And he's saying it's based on the work itself. And he kind of like changed the whole way how we critique today work of art. I can find this article, I haven't forgot his name.
But you critique the work itself as opposed to what? Critiquing the intentions of the artist?
Right. No, you cannot come with a set of rules. He's saying you cannot come with a set of rules to critique. You can critique only once you stand in front of the work, and the work itself gives you the rules to critique itself.
And it's not only about art, because
right.
It is an art school, but most of the people that are not into
It's an aesthetic school in a way. It's very odd. And I think Nareen's right, there's not a crisp.
We don't sit squarely in a tradition that we can draw on and say, well, we're going to do it this way because we do X.
Maybe, but X, what you've been doing with the brick.
Yeah, brick platform. Well, first of all, one thing I realized, I think critique is really the wrong word that people aren't really looking for critique. It's just the word that closely fits. I think it's more of a pushing, like, because there's such this open sort of playground effect that people aren't pushed in any way towards, like, there's nothing that's making do a little better. There's nothing that's saying, like, step it up one another notch. There's no push at all. Just like, okay, do what you want to do. And so in an art school, the critique is the function that then pushes you to accelerate. But in ITP, there's very little.
Sometimes
or
not, though.
Sometimes.
Or
to fail. Yeah,
right,
yeah,
it can
break you or it can,
right.
You know, make you. But in ITP, there's very little. Like, you know, it's like, find whatever you want to do and sort of do it. But and then nobody will tell you if it's not that great. So there's very little push to, like,
I was going to say, I think it's a weighing of the individual contribution versus what it is that you're critiquing or what the subject is, and that's where some of the trouble lies in this, is that at ITP there's so much group emphasis and group everything and pulling these people from different backgrounds together. And the critique all of a sudden says, okay, just you now speak about this group thing, or this larger involvement. And so you find yourself coming from a certain perspective or background. And that can be discounted easily. So people feel like people are just more hesitant as an individual to speak out towards any group or activity than they would be in a smaller group. I kind of tried to tackle this in the paper, and that was one of the things, was that if before, we did this a couple times in class, but if when you had to speak to somebody's project that you just heard about, if you were going out and getting coffee with somebody downstairs, you would probably have a really good discussion of it and talk through what you really thought. But if it was just you, you know, speaking to the class, it's totally different because you can volley back and forth from people's totally different backgrounds and form a cohesive opinion.
I think to a large degree, one of the things that that probably gets overlooked a lot is, or I guess it's an underlying assumption that critique ought to come from, you know, the professor. And I think what we've developed here at ITP, which I think is probably pretty unique, is that we tend to support and critique each other. So what we really have developed is peer review, as opposed to professor review, or what, you know, whatever you want to call that. And I think that's probably something that happened spontaneously because of the void of formal critique. But at the same point, since all of us come from different backgrounds, it's maybe not as poignant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also you're like, Liz, like you didn't really know where the other person comes from or where it comes from, and then so like you might not have the same knowledge to be able to criticize it based on, right, if it's an architect and I'm not, how do you create?
I don't know if that's a big factor.
I can critique a film, and I've never shot a film. You know, I think for one thing it's a graduate level program, so it's kind of like a lot of us have gone through the criticisms of undergraduate schools. I think in order to answer the question, we have to look at, you know, other art schools in this building and say, has their critique ramped up?
But you wouldn't be critiquing a film. That's the thing about projects, is that you don't even know what a lot of these things are.
That's exactly what I was getting at. A lot of the things in this,
you've seen the presentation.
It's not a traditional, it's not a form where, you know, we've seen before, there's a convention used, and there's some.
But think too, I was in the context of this class, think about the social effects. What's the difference in modes of production between ITP and art school?
The first thing for me that is very obvious is that we actually see only results. We don't see the process. We don't have studios, that we don't hang things on the walls. I cannot come to one of you just, you know, unless I peek on the top of the computer. But all our work is
accidentally hidden
in our computers, unless it's on the floor or in the show. So we kind of like see the results, and for me, I'm missing very much having a studio here and just, you know, eating my lunch in the studio while I visit somebody else and talking about work rather than in the lunch. This is the first thing that.
What else is different?
It's much less focused, you know, very broad-based program. Like, if you go get an MFA in painting, well, like, you're going to learn how to paint. And, like, you have to find your little place in that program. But, like, you're going to do, like, eight, you know, just paint and paint and paint. And then maybe do some color theory.
And there is not a certain career that you're supposed to come up with. You can become an artist, you can open a startup, and you can become, you know, an employee in somewhere, or do something completely different. It's not that you're supposed to become an artist. You're supposed to become something to do with technology and creativity or something.
Yeah, I guess a lot of departments are all shooting for the same spot, basically. Everyone's trying to get to the same place, but we're all like...
My image for it is that most graduate schools are a funnel. People come from all over, and then a stream of lawyers exit to the bottom. And ITP is an hourglass, right? We've got the neck of the hourglass. But people go to as many places as they come from. But there's something about production here, and it may be easier for me to see than you guys, because you're in the thick of it. And having gone through first an art school and then come here, which is that art making is, whether it needs to be or not, it is considered in this country at this time essentially solitary work. The hand of the artist on the canvas or on the material and so forth. And that, I mean, this thing Michael's talking about, the sort of solo critique effect makes perfect sense because it's one artist to another one. I'm struck by, even on the individual projects that I see taking place, the amount of lateral cooperation that goes on.
in part because while I'm building this thing, it's a server-side database that's combining a bunch of inputs and presenting them. The output screen, I'm not a designer, right? I can do something that dumps HTML, but I want it to look a little nicer. And so I press a friend into service for all of half an hour of their work, but that's more collaboration than almost any painting produced at any art school in this country ever sees. And that's a very low level of collaboration. Then we have, obviously, things formally done by groups, but even stuff that looks individual often contains a collaborative element, even if it's just grabbing somebody more knowledgeable about a subject than you for 5 minutes in the hallway. And one of the things from the outside looking in, it seems to me, is that critique, because it's person to person, or that's the way that's the sort of critique tradition brought in when you discuss the art school terms, actually risks the social capital of association, open association on the floor. And so one of the things I'm wondering, looking, again from an outside standpoint, is there a way to make critique more of a cultural norm, so that the threat from critique is the threat to not collaborating with those individuals in the future, or a factionalism in a way.
What is the threat of critique?
The threat of critique is if I go and I say, oh my goodness, that's the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
That's bad critique.
Yeah, that's right, fair enough. If I go and I say, I don't understand what you're doing, or I think you failed in this way, and you take personal offense, then the strength of the personal connection between the critiquer and the critiquee is damaged. And is there a way to make that relationship either withstand or even be strengthened by critique, but still have the critique be essentially, as Abe might put it, bar-raising bad news as well? And I can see what you're trying to do. It's not working. Here's why, or here's what I think.
Need an obvious.
Okay.
But still, it can be just as damaging.
Yeah, exactly. Even more so.
Why?
Why that?
Yeah, because you don't know. You don't know where. For example, someone who's critiquing you. You know where the critique is coming from, and from what direction, and from what background that person is.
You don't know what hit you. You don't know what hit you.
Exactly. If you don't know where it's coming from. You have nothing to draw upon a history or a reference to anybody who might be critiquing you, then you're just like...
Yeah, and there's two other things. One is that it might allow people to be harsher and nastier because they can hide behind this veil. And the other thing is sort of a paranoia, like you're wondering, like, who was it that
who's
said that?
Like,
who is my friend, who's my enemy? Right?
Just the way, like some sort of dialectic of critique, like using a Liz Lehrman kind of thing, where if you want critique, it's based on the questions that you ask, the artist asks. So you're like, if everybody, I would like input. Can you tell me how you feel about?
This is based on a
Liz Lehrman. It's a theater or a dance, a group critical response, and it's just a process where you begin. Everybody would go around and say, this is what I liked about your piece, and these are the questions I have, and then it's like open for I ask the group a question what did you think about, when the dancer ran over to the corner and put her hands over her eyes, and then people can give me feedback. And then the final stage is you can say to me, I have an opinion about,
something you
that dancer, would you like to hear it? And I can choose whether, it's actually annoying to be in this kind of thing to a certain degree, but there is something valuable about it that the critique is based on, you can choose what you want to hear about. Like, I don't want to hear about my color selection in my paintings, so don't tell me about my color selection. I'm going to ask you, will you tell me, did I sign it in the right place? Yeah. Did I do it on the back? I don't know.
Well, I mean, that sounds to me like a great idea.
Mm-hmm. But maybe to have every person give comment, because I know, in the classes in my past that some of the international students, everybody, because ITP has a lot of people from diverse backgrounds, and everybody comes from a different culture. And for instance, I'm from Korea, and the Koreans are not very confrontational. So a lot of times, either because they are not comfortable with English, or because they are brought up with the culture that they're not used to speaking in public, or they're not very comfortable. They'll just stay quiet. But I'm sure when you talk to them in person, they have a lot of their opinions in mind. So maybe have each person give feedback as a mandatory.
So, right,
so everybody will say something.
But part of it's also just generating a shared vocabulary, because, like, I mean, going back, like, at any school, people know what, you know, like, you know, at least what the, you know, things are very crystallized.
I'm not sure, I mean.
But it's like, how do you critique, like, the, you know, John Schimmel's, his Fireflies? Like, how do you, like, what context do you put that in? Like, how do you critique, like, you know, is that a, it's not a painting. You know? Like it's hard to critique because it's a new language, right? And it's not necessarily, it's not even a shared language because somebody else might be doing a dance performance.
And, but in a way, it's supposed to be one of the goals of this department.
To
develop a discourse of new media. And it can do that because people are coming.
I'm not sure that that's true, actually. We have only one theorist on staff. Right? Doug Rushkoff is the only person here who does anything that looks like theory from the traditional academic. I mean, again, this is my personal view of the program. This is not received wisdom. It seems to me that ITP is artifact culture, that we advance by having objects, loosely conceived, sometimes on the screen, to look at, and using those as exemplars, and developing a way of talking about those, but not so much a conceptual attitude that exists in advance of any given piece of work. So when Fireflies shows up, there is absolutely this vocabulary lack. On the other hand, I think that is the possibility of Fireflies showing up is greater if there isn't a framing that says, oh, things like Firefly would be stupid because you don't know if it's art or not. So it's we don't have quite the theoretical goal to say Katie's program over at Parsons or whatever.
I think the fact that that ITT like flirts a bit with art,
mm-hmm.
it drops the basis of all the discourse, and it shouldn't, because
you should read Jan's paper. He, this is exactly his. The paper was on the latent group of people who are artists at ITP who are largely invisible to one another in a larger sea of aesthetic, but not necessarily artistic production. So, I mean, this is a perfect example, I think, of by strengthening that group, you potentially tip.
But I think that's my opinion about art. No? Mm-hmm. But I think that there should be a certain basis to a discourse about art, and it is because there is art history, and there is starting to be new media history,
mm-hmm.
So that should be a basic cultural basis for a discourse about new media.
Right. All I meant is that I don't think it's a specific goal of ITP to produce a shared critical language among its graduates.
But there
I mean,
it has to be shared.
Otherwise,
I'm just taking this example, John Chinas. If we don't have the tools to criticize such a work, then the artist should, you know, put us in the context of that work and give us aim us where to look at, and then we do have the tools to criticize such a work. I don't think we don't have tools to criticize different work, but if we are aimed to a specific context, and then actually in that way share our own backgrounds or bring our backgrounds into whatever we do here, then we do have tools to criticize.
But I think it has to be in the direction of, you know, diversity is the program's greatest strength, and I think that we're never going to leave with a shared vocabulary because the incoming vocabularies are so diverse.
I mean, the program's very deliberately anti-historical. Like, I'm not saying that as a fact. That's my opinion. Very deliberately. Like, you know, there's no tenure. There's no like. Does he have real tenure?
He has real tenure, but he's the associate. I mean, he's a different category than the rest of us. That's right. There's no tenure, and there's no emphasis on knowing other people who've made similar attempts in the past. And that is official policy, which is going back and having to read everybody who's tried everything, tried something very similar to what you're thinking of, will just bum you out. And so, don't read that stuff. Or rather, you're welcome to read it if you like, but we're not going to dump the weight of previous failed attempts, in part because the kinds of things we're interested in have People did it 10 times and it didn't work, and then the 11th time worked because some part of social environment plus technological changes plus your particular idea nailed it after 10 failed attempts. And Red's philosophy is strongly that knowing the 10 failed attempts is something that should happen more in the middle of the work, as it were. Start, get interested in what you're interested in, start down the path, and then start looking sideways. So I think that the anti-historical bias is actually...
Yeah, and there's zero documentation. Like, there's some mention at the beginning, and then there's, like, this decade and a half that there's zero, and, you know, there's nothing. No, it's a black hole. Like, what happened?
Red was embarrassed that people remembered that the place was 25 years old last year. Like, a little bit like Megan trying to hide the... hide the origin of the drive-bys. Red really does not have that kind of legacy
argument. I wonder if that's part of the failure of the full foresight that everybody keeps trying to push, is that something like that would have probably a much longer memory.
So floor four, I was going to say, why has floor four failed? It's failed three times in the past, and without, obviously they're trying something relatively different than the current version, and it's not up yet, but thinking now about past efforts, what is it that keeps 4-4 from succeeding?
I think the people that maintain it.
We have the turnover of students.
No, but it's people who maintain drive-bys left.
But it's been
people who maintain TNO left.
It's a different type of structure than a drive-by. I mean, it's like a technological structure, and the person who wrote it probably wrote it in a certain way that...
But it's never failed for technological reasons.
Yeah,
it's failed because
it takes a lot of directed energy. You know, it's supposed to be a blog now, and I was when people were saying let's put a blog up, like who's going to write for it? There's who's going to put stuff up daily? You know, it takes an incredible amount of focus to make it successful.
Yeah,
and like even if
I think that's it. And that's the thing I was trying to. Whenever I was kind of involved in trying to brainstorm it, I'm like, well. What is it that this website can do that will drive people from the listserv? And then more importantly, which is a better process? What helps? What benefits the students the most? So
the Locus Centric, I find that there's the wiki. I mean, at least last year there was a wiki, and then there's the help desk, and then there's the listserv,
but it's
a few listservs, and then there's
it's the threshold of like what it takes to post, right? And so like to maintain a blog is a high threshold activity. Mm-hmm. And even if you can get one person who does it for 1 year and it succeeds, like to find somebody else is
it could succeed in getting content, but what it's failed to do is get readers. Even when it has succeeded in having content, it has failed to get readers.
It hasn't succeeded well.
And the listserv is not. Like the listserv is consistently and it's in part I think because my interpretation why floor four is running into trouble is in part the listserv, and in part the fact that we're all on the fourth floor. Right? There actually is a floor four, and the department is so compact, and when we expanded and took over that space next door, Red made the lounge the single most important space in the entire building. Right? It's not the classrooms, it sure isn't the faculty offices, right? It's the lounge. Right? The lounge is the size of two classrooms and two faculty offices. And space in New York is at a premium. And that's the engine that runs this program. And in a way, the kind of broadcast value of 4-4, like people kind of know. When things happen, it ripples through the population in lots of ways. So that's an interesting case of a social dynamic and a technological dynamic crossing. The 4-4 people are always up against the actual tightness of the target population plus the listserv
last one was, at least when it started, the target population was actually outside of ITP. It's supposed to be a means of broadcasting.
From ITP, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that iteration.
Maybe they should just publish selected writings off the listserv.
What I was arguing for was a reblog.
Something better.
See, after you just explained to me the philosophy behind it, almost discourages me from even getting any involvement. I'm not doing anything with it right now anyway. But the fact that like Red's kind of built this perfect little like wonderland where people come in and they don't know anything. They can't look to the left or right. I have no idea where to research PCOM stuff because I know nothing about it. But if you put that kind of foundation in there, that totally changes things. And I think that kind of fights the philosophy.
I don't understand.
He's saying the archiving effect may be swimming upstream against the cultural norms of
progress. In the case of PCOM, for instance, that's not true. I mean, as more information is being archived, we're actually generating social knowledge capital.
Right.
And it's very valuable.
Right.
And then the question is, where should that be linked from? And if Fourth Floor turns out to be a place where those links make sense. But the problem with blogging is even blogging has a short institutional memory and sort of standard iteration. You can go back to the permalinks. But to keep the permalinks, you've got to have them somewhere. And maybe, you know, and then you start just getting to that. Are you going to be putting things on the wiki that are pointers to the blog that you got off the listserv kind of thing? So it'll be interesting.
The problem is, I believe the archiving is needed in many ways, but a blog is not the best format for archiving at all.
All right,
let's take a break. And when we get back, I'm going to try and tell this last 5 weeks as a story, and then we'll talk about moving into this kind of conversation about technological mediation as well.